Okay, here we go.
Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. I am co-chair Vic Gilliam. This is not my day to chair. I know you're all disappointed that I'm doing this, but Representative Cannon will be back shortly. And he, for some unknown reason, left the gavel in my hand. Now, I'd like to make a couple of announcements about our agenda. The first is, this will be my 10th apology to Dr. Bateman, but we don't have a critical mass yet. We expect to by about 3:30, and at that point, we will open up a work session on House Bill 126. If you're here for House Bill, excuse me, I said Senate Bill, didn't I? Senate Bill 126. If you're here for Senate Bill 626 or Senate Bill 518, we are holding those over till our next meeting. And so I wanted you to be aware of that if that's why you're here. So with that announcement, I would like to open an informational hearing on the carbon economy in Oregon. And the first thing I'd like to do before I ask folks up is to assure everyone that this is not a round two necessarily on House Bill 3538, which is actually up for consideration next door in a Senate committee today. The issues in that bill may very well be part of our discussion, but I'm hoping we sort of, you know, I'll borrow the cliche, big picture, that we take a big picture look. I'm interested in everyone's input, but it doesn't have to be. In fact, I prefer it not be specifically about that bill. I hope I haven't confused everyone, but I hope you understand. We're looking forward to this discussion. And do we have a sign-up sheet, or do we just ask folks?
We just ask folks, and I think if you could start with the ecosystems,
good.
They have another time.
Great.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Krieger.
Representative Betts and I both thought we understood this until you made your explanation.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm here for, Representative.
Right, and Mr. Chair, do we get to weigh in on how disappointed we are?
Yes, you do, as soon as Representative Cannon gets back. So, in the interest of some other schedules, would Duncan Berry, would Guy Sievert, and David Ford come forward? And whoever would like to go first, could just identify for the record.
Okay. So my name is Duncan Berry, and I am of Otis, Oregon, for the record. And I'm with Ecosystem Services, act as president. So co-chairs, members of the committee, we also have Guy Sievert, David Ford with us, for the record. So we're going to try to keep to that big picture, co-chair. And what we're here today as is the three of us are business people. So what we're going to show you is an actionable, market-based big picture around the carbon economy in Oregon. This is not a prescription, and it is also not there had been a request for legislative concepts. I would say this is prior to the legislative concept because we believe that this really warrants a working session and potentially generation of a bill over time. So keep that in mind that these are early thought starters for us all. One of the other distinctions we want to make is that we are also not looking at the entire carbon sector, but really focusing on bio-based carbon here. And if you follow the Governor's Advisory Group on Global Warming, in their Oregon Strategy for Greenhouse Gas Reduction Report, there were four key areas that they felt really would move the needle in terms of reduction of emissions. We are focusing on the one in the lower right-hand corner, and that is an increase in biological sequestration. And if the metaphor is we are not New Jersey, so we do not have a lot of manufacturing and industrial carbon to mitigate. We have a lot of natural resources as our greatest asset. So that's what we're concentrating on. So the goals, really, today there are three, and we're talking about utilizing those same really truly world-class biological assets that we have in our forests, our agricultural lands, and in our waterways. The second is really generating both rural, very badly needed rural jobs, but also urban jobs. So there's a balance in this. And this is a big piece of this, potentially new revenue for state agencies by keeping dollars in the state and attracting potentially foreign carbon offset dollars. Lastly, it's meeting those same Oregon legislative carbon emission goals that we talked about just before. So what are the current conditions that we're sitting in today? Because I think in this building alone, carbon is not the most popular subject. It has been a divisive subject, and we've been told just lately by the Treasurer's Office that's a fairly dead subject right now, or one that we're going to be dealing with later. So what we're saying is we are surrounded globally by other economies that are focused on this issue, and we are neighbors with a state that is showing a great initiative and could look to us for supply. So, untapped resources. The current condition is that this carbon economy roadmap seeks to address the fact that this valuable capacity, the soils, forests, and wetlands that we have here in Oregon, have the capability of offsetting all of our carbon emissions while generating jobs and revenues. But this is a largely untapped resource while millions of dollars leave this state. These are our assets. So carbon sequestration in soil, carbon sequestration in our forests, carbon sequestration in our wetlands and our ocean. And there's no one that will dispute it. We have world-class sequestration assets. Second current condition, flight of capital. So every day that goes by, Oregon utility customers, businesses, and others are spending money on carbon emissions. Most of these are spent on industrial-based carbon offsets and or located outside the state or the country. These represent just a fraction of the potential offsets that would be purchased if the process were to be made easier or, and this is a word we don't say easily, mandated, and investments were being made in our local communities. The third and final current condition, lack of action and projects. So there is a lot of talk about carbon. There are state, regional, and national carbon regulations in various stages of development. Tons of players sitting on the sidelines. Oregon tends to be one of those. There are streams of studies. And the other thing that we would like to say is we are not an NGO up here. There are three of us. We are not NGOs. We are not university personnel. And this is not another white paper or another study. This is an actionable roadmap for pulling your boots on and doing it on bio-based projects in Oregon. And if you don't remember anything else about today, that is a key piece of this. So those are three of the current conditions that have led us, really compelled us to draft a roadmap for the carbon economy in Oregon. So here's a supply to a demand roadmap. It's five-step, and I will underscore that it's market-driven, and that with your help, it would employ both incentives, but it would also employ regulations to accelerate both the demand and the supply of these carbon offsets, not only within Oregon, but attracting demand from outside Oregon. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the figure, but $144 billion is a lot of cash, and that was what was spent both in the regulatory and in the volunteer markets on carbon globally. Within this state, we are, as of 2010, for the entire year, we didn't make $1 million worth of bio-based carbon in this state. So the other piece of it is regional and national carbon legislation is fairly bogged down in progress. What we're saying is we don't need to wait on the sidelines of these markets. So if you look at the five steps, they involve standards, competition, regulation, incentives, and the establishment of policy. And I also want to point out that we see the supply of these bio-based carbon offsets being provided by businesses, NGOs, and potentially state agencies. The demand for those would be internal to this state, keeping dollars here, also national markets, and potentially Kyoto Protocol countries in some categories. So let's talk about the opportunities. Utilize standards that incent action. We feel that many of the national carbon standards currently employed are in their teenage years, if you will. They have created technical or financial barriers to the practical development of rigorous offset projects for businesses, and in this case, right here in the capital for state agencies. We need to analyze what these barriers are and redraft the Oregon carbon dioxide standard and or utilize new protocols so we encourage and don't discourage projects here in Oregon. Let's ensure competition. So as we know, there's $12 million going to be spent of utility ratepayers' dollars.
Sorry for the disruption. We'll get all settled here in just a second.
No worries. Co-chair. So the utility customer base in Oregon is preparing over the next few years in the near future to spend $12 million. And what we're saying is that our free enterprise system has always worked well because of healthy competition. We're saying one of the opportunities that we have is to update the FSEC monetary path guidelines to allow for additional qualified organizations to identify and fund offset projects. We really believe that the ratepayers will get their money's worth. Yeah. And lastly, the opportunity for the third of the five is fair regulation. Examine business sectors other than utilities for inclusion in either a voluntary or compliance market. That's a biggie. That's not said lightly. Incorporate proposed amendments to HB 3538 and future legislation that give real options for offsetting emissions to utilities and other potential compliance industries. Broaden the oversight of carbon and other ecosystem service offsets in Oregon beyond just FSEC, because there will be a lot more supply. Given that Oregon's carbon standard and offset market was, you know, really the inception of it was 14 years ago, we're saying the U.S. and world markets were not as developed as they are now. Let's make Oregon more competitive in these new markets. An incentive to grow demand. So if you consider monetary incentives for projects that use Oregon assets to benefit Oregon, set Oregon standards allow for small local projects to be aggregated in an offset fund. We hear this every single day, that not every project can be 100,000 acres as they are in a lot of third world countries. That's a function that we believe a regulatory agency could provide. The last is review business tax policy for offset projects. And finally, and really quite importantly, is this clarity of policy. We have dealt with several state agencies who were very confused about whether or not they had the opportunity to this new revenue source. We've spent a lot of time with the Department of Justice talking about it. So allow for state agencies to sell ecosystem service assets to support projects supporting their mission. And we have a list of state agencies that we feel would be well qualified that have those assets. Also, develop a method of surety of state agency offset assets that allow for market participation. This is one of the reasons, one of the contributing reasons that the Oregon Parks and Recreation deal fell through, is this surety issue around 175 years of monitoring. Finally, link the objectives of HB 3109 and 3538, because they have some very similar languages and very similar intents, and it doesn't seem like they're being crosswalked at this time. This would create an actual ecosystem service offset market in Oregon if that was done. Mandate that offset projects use Oregon assets for majority of carbon offset projects utilizing utility monies. Seems to make sense. Now, I just want to take one moment and explore the state agency piece, and then we'll wrap up. There is an agency here that has really explored this opportunity of new revenue, and that is the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. We worked with them for over a year to come to understand carbon better. As part of that, we encouraged them to look backwards. I think this is the first audit that's ever been done of a state agency here, but one of the few in the United States. What we did is we said, let's go back through all your granting process, both restoration and acquisition, and let's see what carbon you sequestered. This was quite rigorous. It took us about 6 months reviewing all the projects. So we cast out a lot that we could not identify all the information for. What we found was actually quite interesting and shows some range here, you know, from 1.2 million to 2.2 million just based on carbon value. But just in 1 year of restoration projects, OEB was able to generate this sort of revenue if you had taken these projects to market. What we further did is we looked at the acquisitions they had made since the inception of the agency in 98. That figure climbs. So we're at 2.9 to as much as 5.4. And I would say these are very conservative figures, both in carbon value and in the way we calculated the offsets. The other thing that we did, and this is just to show you that this is actionable, is we created a roadmap for all their grantees where they could actually sit down. What you're seeing here is, how do you identify a targeted project that's a carbon project? We then said, these are the questions you ask. These are the actions you take. These are the key resources you will need. I'm not going to bore you with this anymore, but any more of this particular slide, but the point we're trying to make is that there is an actionable path for state agencies that would result in additional revenue. Finally, we customized it because Oregon's a big state, so we took the six regions and we actually customized it to all the different ecotone types and habitats for Oregon. So to wrap up, next steps as we see them. This is a big enough opportunity in our minds that it really warrants the convening of a small working group. We put business first because I think that is, in the order of things, a very, very important player in a markets-based project or a markets-based initiative. We then also would encourage key agencies to be there, but only the appropriate ones, participation of NGOs and university members. The second is really coordinate that language in 3109, 3538, and finally, draft a concept framework for a market-based carbon economy bill to be introduced in the next legislative session. This is just a pump primer, but we do not want another blue ribbon panel made up of 48 people. This would be a very concise surgical strike towards something that could be actionable. What we're saying here is that, you know, this is an idea of the representative community that would be invited to the table. And I would also say a disclaimer about our presentation today. These are our ideas. We're a small group. We do represent business, but it needs the bandwidth of this particular bill, if it were to be written, needs to be expanded. You will note under state agencies, OEB, DSL, OPRD, ODF, these are agencies that do have physical assets that could potentially realize revenue from those assets. Thanks for bearing with that. That's a lot of dense detail in a short space of time. Our main purpose for being here today really is to have a lively dialogue about next steps and any questions you might have regarding what we just showed you.
Great. Thanks for the presentation. Let's see first if there are questions for the committee. I guess I apologize. I missed the start, and you may have covered this. But could you describe a little more sort of the role of your organization, your company, what you do now, what you're proposing to do in convening this or helping urge others to convene this work group? What is your role?
So I think there's two companies here. So okay. There's Ecosystem Services, which is a guy's and my company that we're representing, and then we have LNC Carbon as well. I can tell you Ecosystem Services, basically carbon is one of the services that we bring to markets, but we specialize in uniting supply chains. So they deliver something someone has, say a forest, into a carbon market. So we are project developers, so we knit those pieces together and bring things to market. Our role, as we see it, is being part of this small community of people that are actually in that supply chain rather than people from outside that are studying it or have a particular concept or theory. As we say, we understand our portion of this ecosystem. We believe it's ready and ripe to deliver revenue to the state, and we would provide the perspective of business and a project developer, and we would be happy to play some role in organizing the conceptual legislative format.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to be clear. So your business is about helping identify and put together the projects that may qualify as carbon reduction projects. So you're working with, maybe it's a state agency, but it may be a private landowner who's taking some action with their, or proposing to take some action with their land that would help offset carbon. You are working with them to identify a funding source for that carbon reduction. Is that like?
Basically. Okay. Yeah, I would say not limited to that. We're very involved with water and other issues,
okay.
But that's one of the things that we...
Did you want to
jump? Excuse me, yes. My name is Guy Siever, the Ecosystem Services and Managing Partner. One of the things that we have been involved with, and just another example, is the municipality, City of Lincoln City, that has some source water issues and is making efforts to protect its source water in the Schooner Creek. And one of the things that we are helping them is to do is to take a look at the assets in Schooner Creek, and if the city owned or controlled all those assets, how could they do it? How could they manage it? What would be both the costs and revenues and things like that? It involves, one of the pieces involves carbon sequestration. Other pieces involve, you know, sustainable harvesting and other kinds of things that the city would be involved in. So there, in this particular case with the City of Lincoln City, it's about protecting water. Carbon happens to be a piece of the puzzle, but only one piece.
Yeah, and I asked the question in part because I have a sort of follow-up question related to how we ensure that these reductions in carbon or this clean water is real. Because somebody's paying for it, right? This money doesn't just materialize. It may come from utility ratepayers. It may come from water ratepayers. It may come from others. But there has to be some, and I think this is it's certainly a big concern of mine, there has to be some guarantor that the project that says it's reducing carbon right. is actually reducing carbon. Mm-hmm. And I just want to be... my impression is that you are not proposing to play that role of the guarantor. I think we need no. some sort of independent, and of course the Climate Trust has been an entity that is attempting right. to verify that they're not actually doing projects. They're verifying the projects that say they're reducing carbon or reducing carbon. I just want to...
They too are not a guarantor, but yeah, right.
So you're not proposing to play that role?
No.
No.
Okay.
No, there are several really quality standards in the United States for voluntary carbon projects. Climate Trust uses one, but there are others. And, you know, we think that's whether Oregon wants to develop its own standards like California has done and expand those or to look for ways to develop a standard that works for Oregon only, for Oregon projects. That's actually part of what we're suggesting that this work group would look through. Not all projects in Oregon will necessarily kind of shape up well to the California standards or to some other international standards. So we think that's something that really needs to be looked at for Oregon. There's no set rule here. There was no set rule for Climate Trust other than to follow the Oregon carbon standard. They make up their own standard, or what they select for a standard is not determined by the legislature, for instance.
Let me just add something. David Ford, LNC Carbon. We're a subsidiary of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. We're interested in this. We do project development work as well. We're trying to find ways to engage family woodland owners, and I also own family woodlands in Yamhill County. We're trying to find ways because family landowners have, and not just family landowners, but private landowners here in the state, manage for a variety of outputs, and many of them don't just focus on timber as a primary output. And so trying to find ways to create opportunities for them to be able to participate and generate new revenue streams that will allow them to continue to manage on a sustainable basis and improve their management over time is an important goal that we have. For LNC Carbon, you know, our role, much like Duncan and Guy's, is not designed to, you know, we're not here for a self-serving purpose. We're here because we're trying to figure out a way to engage and grow this market over time to allow those that are managing some of these natural resources to be able to be rewarded for improving their management over time. And keeping some of those dollars here in Oregon, not have capital flee like we're seeing existing today. Currently, a number of projects that are being funded by Oregon ratepayers aren't happening in Oregon. They're happening in other states. We would like, and part of the reason this has to do with infrastructure, we believe. Part of it has to do with standards as well. And, for example, right now there are three credible, we think, standards that exist out there, registries that exist, CAR, which is a California group, the American Carbon Registry, which is based on the East Coast. We just submitted a protocol to help include family landowners in that. That's being recognized in the voluntary market. And then there's the Voluntary Carbon Registry as well, which is another one, which is an international-based organization. So much like in forest certification, you have these different independent third-party bodies that are setting the rules, and then there are organizations that develop projects to achieve those rules, and then you have a third-party verification process to ensure that those rules are being met. And I think that really addresses your concern, Co-Chair Cannon. It's to make sure there's credibility in that system. However, here in Oregon, we have these tremendous assets, and yet we're still not in a position to be able to participate much in offering carbon into that voluntary market. And there's a lot of reasons for that, and part of what we're interested in doing is beginning to appeal that back and understand why that's the case. We don't have all the answers, but we do believe the reason we're here today is because we want to find those answers, and we want to do it in a way that will generate in increasing the economic opportunity here in Oregon for Oregonians, not export, I guess, our dollars to other places where they are doing it. You want to add anything to that?
No. Thank you. I'll get to you. Representative Gilliam has a question. Do you have separate presentations? I just want to be cognizant of time.
No, okay. We don't. We collaborated on that presentation so we could then spend more time in Q&A.
Appreciate that. Representative Gilliam.
Just thank you, Mr. Chair. Duncan, is that available?
It is.
Good, because I'd love a copy, and we can distribute it to the committee as well.
We'll follow it.
Thank you. It's a good presentation.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question always seems to be the political will to continue the programs once they get started. And, and when the economy goes south, then all of a sudden all these great ideas and great concepts go by. So all the folks that have been trying to put these programs together, the rug sure got underneath them, and time passes. Have I described the situation, or am I 2 or 3 years back? You can give us a true up on
this. Let me take at least the first shot at that, David Ford. Actually, from a family woodland owner perspective, when the economy goes south like it has here in recent times, the value of harvesting timber doesn't bring much revenue to those folks that own forest land. So they are quite interested and excited, at least from the supply side, of finding ways to increase their economic revenue generation by offering something besides timber to the market, because you could sell timber in the market and lose your shorts, so to speak. And so in those times, it's really, I think, family landowners in particular are looking for alternatives to add to a timber harvest regime that would add some economic return based on their management activities. On the demand side, there is a worldwide demand for carbon offsets, and that program is growing, both from a regulatory perspective, because what's happening in the EU, as well as what's happening in California today with a regulated market going into effect January 1st of next year. So there's both that, there's two kind of drivers. There's government action, like the EU and California. There's private action, companies like Nike and others that are now disclosing their carbon footprints through what they call the Carbon Disclosure Project, which is a UK-based project where companies voluntarily disclose their carbon footprints. And as of 2009, I think they started in 2003, and there was only about 250 companies globally that were reporting. As of the end of 2009, there were almost 2,500 companies, including Nike and
Walmart.
Walmart. Yeah, there's a number of U.S.-based companies that are part of that. So. I don't know if that answers your question, but maybe gives you a little bit of flavor the way we think about it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just relating what I've read recently in various sources that would suggest that it's the going to the broader population, whether it's the ratepayers or whoever it is, and saying we're going to raise your rates so we can fund these kinds of programs. Mm-hmm. And we encounter then what Coach Arcanon referenced, which is measuring inability, standards, rules, all the stuff, all the machinery, all that process has to be put in place to make this work. That's one thing. But the other part of actually convincing people they need to pay for carbon sequestration seems to be a major issue, particularly when the economy turns south. Now, again, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe because I had heard on the exchange markets for this that there wasn't one, that they had been one, but it's fallen upon tough times. Is that incorrect?
That's incorrect. Yeah. David, for that's incorrect. Actually, the amount of carbon that's being, the prices certainly have suffered a bit, but in the UK or in the EU right now, prices are still around $20 a ton for carbon. Here in the U.S., cartons, which are the California, which are going to be the regulated market, are the floor is going to be set at $10 a ton in the California market as of January 1st. Today, they're being discounted. They're about $8. Some of the voluntary standards are somewhere in the $5 to $6 per ton range. So they certainly have dropped off compared to what they were a few years ago, but that's to be expected like any commodity in the marketplace. Those values go up and down. But I understand your point about ratepayers. If it's a regulated market, you know, people are going to be concerned about increasing their rates. But in the voluntary market, willing buyers and willing sellers are setting those prices every day today.
You know, I wonder if I might comment to Representative Vince. Some of the dollars that we're talking about have already been put in place. So we're talking about $12 million to come through FSEC. So that's one focus. I think the other focus is we stand to be in a better position from a domestic standpoint in the voluntary market to supply than to necessarily impose any more, if you will, a carbon tax on the Oregon populace. So we're talking about not only the dollars that are available, we're talking about dollars that could be brought to this state from other markets. So I would also say in that same breath, we did say that one of the potentials here is to mandate to other top emitters, because if you're sitting in PG&E's shoes, they're a sector of the economy that has had a disadvantage, if you will, to their rate structures, and it's something to look at, whether it's voluntary or compliance. Are there other emitters that should be brought into the fold for their input and potential responsibility? So it isn't all just roses, but I think that's a key piece to just analyze as part of this working group.
One follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had heard that California had wanted to limit dramatically those who could offer sequestration to those who are inside California to try to channel those dollars to their own state. And that would seem to make some sense because we've had the same discussions here. Do you anticipate that being more common in the future? That is, let's not let Oregon benefit from California ratepayers.
Well, David Ford, I'm not sure exactly where California is going to end up on that. Their resources board is the one that's controlling that. And they've only have four particular protocols that meet the pre-compliance market, which is gearing up to hit 2012. The challenge that California has is the gap between what they think they can generate from their allocation of how much they're going to let emitters pollute they're going to ratchet that down every year, right, beginning in 2012. And so that gap continues to grow about how much offsets they're going to need in the marketplace. And the fear that the regulators have at this point is when you look at them, we've looked at some of the graphs that they've put together, it comes a quite a large gap between what they can fulfill with their existing protocols versus what's going to take when you go out to 2020 to be able to fill that gap. So California regulators are looking at they're creating a lot of demand, and they're not sure they can fulfill the demand based on their approach at this point. So they're trying to evaluate as we speak today how they might address that potential gap, because obviously if it's a supply and demand, if that gap grows too large, what happens to the price per ton? You know, there are estimates that Barclays has put out that it could reach $60 to $80 a ton if they don't deal with that. So that's when some of the regulated components of California will probably scream quite loudly, and we'll probably hear them from down there.
The one thing that I would point out is they're wrestling with the same issues that we've outlined in this roadmap, and that is, how do you build a supply chain? How do you incent it, and how do you regulate it? And they're wrestling with that ahead of us. I think one of the things that we would point out is that even though we have a feeling as if we're stalled in this country in many ways, the rest of the world is going on without us, and some states are going on without us. And so we're just saying that this train sooner or later will come to Oregon, and we can have an opportunity to be proactive and ready for that and supply it, or we can fall behind.
So I want to bring up the other panel here in a moment, but I was intrigued by your suggestion that we should sort of merge these conversations around ecosystem services more generally and carbon in particular. I do think this question of where the offset is achieved looks a little different whether we're talking about carbon or clean water, for example. The reason for saying so, if I am a utility ratepayer, a water utility ratepayer in, or let me put it this way, if a developer is paying to mitigate the wetland impacts of his development, I think it is a reasonable expectation of the people who live in that water system, in that basin, let's say, that the mitigation is occurring to the same water, in a sense. Mm. On carbon, a reduction in carbon in South America is as good for me as a reduction of carbon that occurs as a result of a project in Oregon. Now, granted, the economic impact,
right?
I'm self-interested like the rest of us, right? I want to see that happen in my backyard. But I do think from a kind of environmental standpoint, there's a distinction there that would be interesting to kind of flesh out.
There's Guy Siebert. There's one other component to that, is that, yes, it's the same. The sequestration in Brazil is sequestration in Oregon. But if we don't have those sequestration projects in Oregon, those projects don't get done. It affects the whole ecosystem. So when we tend to approach things by watersheds. We look at whole watershed system health. And if there are not opportunities for a carbon market or water market in Oregon, the whole system health of that watershed suffers. All suffers. Fish and wildlife suffer. Source water suffers.
Human communities
suffer. Economies suffer. So it's a very broad impact. It's much more than CO2 sequestered in Brazil is CO2 sequestered anywhere.
I guess, David Ford, I just would add that one thing. I don't disagree with you. You know, as one of my colleagues used to say, the air doesn't care wherever you sequester the carbon versus where you release it. However, I would actually say that if we're creating the emissions here, our first priority ought to be to take care of our own business at home, right? So if we have the opportunity to be self-reliant and not export our activities and try to mitigate them some other place, it seems to me like if we're making the emissions here in Oregon, we kind of have a, at least from my personal perspective, you know, kind of a moral obligation to see what we can do here at home to mitigate those. We're creating the issue. Let's solve the issue right here rather than exporting that somewhere else. And there's lots of benefits to that, as was just described by Guy. So that's kind of where we come down on it.
Yeah. Thank you. Good answer. Let's leave it there. We have a full committee, which is our opportunity to move quickly into work session to do a bill. Then we'll bring up some other folks to come back to this topic. So I'll leave the informational session open. I appreciate your comments. I hope you'll stick around while we hear from our other presenters. So thank you.
Thanks for asking.
Thank you very much.
So with that, I'm going to leave open the informational meeting, if that's okay, and open a work session on Senate Bill 126. And Mr. Co-Chair, do we have a motion? Do you have a motion?
If you wouldn't mind, we might do the summary.
Oh, yes, for our vast listening audience. Liz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 126 would establish various responsibilities amongst the State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying, the Water Resources Commission, and the Water Resources Department with regard to certifying water right examiners. It also establishes that the board can adopt rules for investigation of alleged or suspected violations and can suspend, revoke, or modify a violator's certificate.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 126 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gilliam moves Senate Bill 126 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? There is none. Senator, will you please call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair
Krueger?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Kim? Aye. Motion carries. Senate Bill 126 to the floor. Anyone want to carry it? Representative Boone, thank you very much. Representative Boone will carry it. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 126. Whew, we're working hard.
No, I just...
All right.
Dr. Bateman gets to go home. Now back to the office.
Thank you, Brenda. Ben, we're still back. We're back in info session. Shauna, Ben, both of you...
For the record, my name is Ben Vitale. I'm president of the Climate Trust.
Thank you.
And my name is Shauna Brownstein. I'm the manager of policy and government affairs at the Climate Trust.
And Ben and Shauna, I know you're that 3538 is up in the next room over, so we'll understand if you need to bounce. And appreciate you following up on the information that we've heard. And if you have a presentation, go ahead and give it, and feel free to respond to anything that came up before.
Great. Well, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to present to you today. I took Representative Gilliam's legislative aide's advice, and this is very high level. And so we are going to do some quick introductions. I'm going to go through some very brief offset fundamentals. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Oregon program, what we've done to date, how it works, and I'll finish with project potential in Oregon, which I think will dovetail nicely with the previous presentation. So the Climate Trust, as you may remember from way back in March, we were founded in 1997 due to the Oregon carbon dioxide standard. We purchase high-quality offsets on behalf of Oregon utilities under the standard. We also manage a number of voluntary and compliance carbon programs, as well as providing technical assistance to corporations, states, and municipalities who are interested in understanding carbon markets. So just a little bit about offsets. You may remember this table from our previous presentation. This is a table of greenhouse gases and their corresponding global warming potential. So what are greenhouse gases? Where do they come from? Starting with the first column, these are the six greenhouse gases that we showed you before. And the second column is common sources. This is not an exhaustive list, but these are some places where you can find these gases. You'll see the first three are fairly common here in Oregon, and to a lesser extent, the last three here in Oregon. And the final column is their global warming potential. So each gas is valued against carbon dioxide. So, for example, methane is 23 times more potent than carbon dioxide, and you'll hear this referred to as carbon dioxide equivalency, or CO2E. So what is an offset? An offset is the reduction, removal, or avoidance of emissions from a specific project used to compensate for emissions occurring elsewhere. So here you see we've got emissions occurring at a factory. That factory decides they want to reduce their emissions, but it's cheaper for them to pay someone else to reduce emissions offsite. So they pay this dairy farm over here, and the dairy farm reduces their emissions. The factory, the key here is the factory then takes ownership of those emission reductions and can make claims associated with those. So they can say, we've reduced our emissions by X percent. One of the things that the previous presenters touched on a little bit is who buys these offsets, who's interested, what's the demand. There are companies that want to make carbon claims. They want to be carbon neutral. There are companies or utilities, entities that have a compliance obligation, maybe in California or here in Oregon, so they're required to purchase offsets or reduce their emissions by a certain amount. And finally, there are companies that just want to do the right thing. They want to be involved in the community. We heard a little bit about Walmart. Walt Disney has done things like this. There are very large corporations in the United States doing this because they want to, not because they're required to. And a lot of that comes from shareholder demand. So what are some types of offset projects? We've got, this is, again, not an exhaustive list, but anaerobic digesters, these deal with methane. They capture methane released from manure, which is typically lagooned on dairy farms. Landfill gas. Landfills release an enormous amount of methane. Landfill gas drills down, captures the methane, and keeps it from being emitted into the atmosphere. It can either flare it or generate renewable energy from it. And another example, which are very prevalent here in Oregon, is reforestation and improved forest management projects. And those are carbon dioxide projects. So one of the things that came up in the last presentation was how are these projects, how do we guarantee these projects are real? I mean, we're dealing with an odorless, colorless gas that's not being emitted. How do we know they're real? Definitions are really important. So this is something that the Climate Trust cares a lot about. It's offset quality criteria. There are significant issues surrounding offsets that have occurred in the past. And to deal with this, the market has responded by creating registries that require very specific verification plans, monitoring plans, that ensure that only real high-quality projects are counted. And these are in these three registries. And this hasn't always been the case, but the Climate Trust is very proud of the work it's done in this area. It spearheaded a collaboration between six national nonprofit organizations to think through how to ensure quality is in policy. How do we ensure offset quality in policy? What are the requirements that we want to put into place? And we're really proud to say that the stringent criteria that we came up with have been adopted by numerous state, regional, and even draft federal legislation, as well as the three registries that are recognized, the American Carbon Registry, the Voluntary Carbon Standard, and the California the Climate Action Reserve. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about the Oregon program and how all of the things I just discussed apply to Oregon. And, you know, how does Oregon interact in this market? So we discussed here in this committee the Oregon carbon dioxide standard and updating it to allow for all six greenhouse gases. It occurred to me that perhaps we didn't do a good enough job explaining how this program works. Basically, every time a new baseload natural gas plant is sited in the state, they have to meet an emission standard. And they can do that four different ways, but the way they've all chosen to do it is through the monetary path. And what they do is they pay, the site certificate holders, for the utilities, pay $1.27 a ton of CO2 over the projected life of the plant in a lump sum to a qualified organization. And that the qualified organization to date has been the Climate Trust. The qualified organization then takes those dollars and invests them in offset projects. Now, yeah.
Is that $1.27 in statute?
It was in statute set at 58 cents a ton, and it was allowed to be increased by 50% every 2 years. Right. And so it's at $1.27 now. And I should say that that is not on par with what the market is requiring at this time, but we're not dealing with that now. We receive $1.27 a ton of CO2, and we take those funds and we invest them in greenhouse gas offsets or in offsets. So one of the issues that also came up was how does an organization become qualified under the Oregon standard? The statute lays out really specific ways that an organization becomes qualified, namely that funds must be used for offsets that result in direct reduction, elimination, sequestration, or avoidance of carbon dioxide emissions. And carbon dioxide is in blue because it's currently being debated on the Senate side, whether or not we're going to be allowed to do other greenhouse gases. Additionally, the statute requires that the organization be governed by a 7-member board of directors. 3 must be appointed by the Energy Facility Siting Council. 3 must be Oregon residents appointed by the Northwest Energy Coalition. That was originally in statute as the Bullitt Foundation, but it says Bullitt Foundation or other approved nonprofit organization as chosen by the council. And so back in 2000, the Northwest Energy Coalition was chosen. So that's who appoints our board members now. And then finally, the utilities appoint 1 board member, and that's typically been a member, a utility employee. We also go through an annual independent financial audit to make sure that we're spending the funds appropriately and according to statute. And we also regularly report the progress of our portfolio to FSEC and utilities. So to date, we have obligated a total of $8.7 million to projects, to 13 projects. 60% of those funds have stayed in Oregon. We've contracted for 2.1 million tons of offsets, and to date, 770,000 offsets have been retired. And over 50% of those reductions have occurred in Oregon. So what is the project potential in Oregon? And, you know, the previous presenters discussed this, and they talked about our natural resources. But I would say that we have many other different types of projects here in Oregon. And one of the types I'm going to talk about is biogas projects. And the Climate Trust just recently completed an exhaustive study of biogas potential in Oregon. And the paper is available. I'll make sure that it's sent to each of you. It's a very readable short paper. But it talks about, it goes through the different sectors of biogas and how many megawatts of renewable energy we could be generating. So how does biogas work? My slides are a little out of order. So in Oregon, there's the potential to generate over 100 megawatts of biogas energy, and currently only 8 megawatts are installed. This is in dairies, wastewater treatment plants, municipal solid waste collectors, and food processors. These are all over the state. These aren't just, on the western side or the eastern side. These are all over the state. Biogas generally works by taking an organic waste, so for example, livestock manure or sewage or residue from food processing, puts it into a digester. The digester then captures the methane and uses it for 3 different things. The methane is used for renewable energy, but the byproducts out of the digester are liquid digestate, which you can use as a fertilizer. You can apply it to farmland. And the benefits of this fertilizer are that it is not petroleum-based, and additionally, it does not have any bacteria in it. So typically right now, dairy farmers use waste and just spread it all over their land. Not only does that increase methane emissions, but manure has salmonella and other bacteria that are really, E. coli, things like that, that are terrible for people. So this kills all of those bacteria but maintains the nutrient value for the soil. The solid digestate, which is the third byproduct of the digester, can be used as livestock bedding. And this is a great revenue source for dairy farmers. They can either use it themselves or they can sell it, but they need to have bedding for their cattle. So just to talk a little bit about...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We all know that Oregon dairy are very much in support of this and excited about this. But the criticism is that it's so expensive to do a digester. Do you have any comments on that? Are we narrowing that? Do you expect the more we do this, obviously the cost is going to come down to do a digester?
Yeah, and carbon financing provides one stream of financing to digesters, but you'll read in the paper that there are multiple streams of financing that go into digesters. And one of the big issues with constructing digesters is the upfront financing that's required. So we do make some policy suggestions in the paper on how to unlock the potential in Oregon by providing bridge loans, revolving loans, things like that, feed-in tariffs that could get this sector off the ground in the state. And there are examples in other states that have been very successful that have a lot of dairies. And there currently are 45 dairy farms that have high potential for digesters in the state. And that's just dairies. That does not count wastewater treatment, landfill gas. I know of an excellent landfill gas project in Roseburg right now. So there are numerous opportunities, and this paper outlines all of them.
I have a follow-up.
This is a little strange, but it's from another question that came up. If you can't answer this, don't worry. But the lagoons are where the digester is built over, so to speak. That's correct. Does it have the potential to either make the lagoon more vulnerable to be ruptured or be otherwise damaged, or does it actually strengthen? It's a totally separate issue of inspection of those lagoons and safety of those lagoons.
Yeah, that's a great question. My understanding of the way digesters work is that the waste is no longer lagooned, but captured and pumped into storage tanks, which extract the methane and various nutrients from the waste. So no longer do you have these lagoons of manure. but the project that I'm about to speak about in Lochmead pumps the waste through three separate tanks. There's another digester that we worked on up in Mount Vernon, Washington, that caps. They put in a special layer underneath the lagoon, and then they cap it, and then they pump the manure through a maze while heating it, which helps release the methane more quickly. But it's not. It's actually much, much better for water quality, air quality, all of those things that lagoons really are problematic around lagoons.
Right. Thank you. That's
yeah. Did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I was just going to say we'd love to take...
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yeah, Ben Vitale, president of the Climate Trust. We'd love to offer to take you for a tour if you want to see the Lochmead Dairy in Junction City. We just had a media tour there with a number of people, including Northwest Natural and others. And Shauna is right. Basically, the way farmers see this is it's a manure management system, and so it actually solves one of their biggest problems. And the Junction City project that Shauna is going to talk about maintains one lagoon for kind of a overflow purposes, but basically the manure management system replaces the open pit lagoons.
Thank you. We might do that.
So I've got one more slide here. This is just a quick overview of Lochmead Dairy. It's a 750-cal dairy in Junction City. It's currently generating 750 kilowatts of renewable energy, and that's equivalent to powering 300 homes per year. It reduces 35,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent over 10 years. That's like taking 700 cars off the road. And I think more interestingly and more relevant for the times that we're discussing this in, it required 5,500 hours of local labor, of cement pours, of plumbers, of electricians in the local area. They did not bring people in. These were all local contractors. And it will continue to require many, many thousands of hours of work over the lifetime of the digester. And those are jobs that are there. They're going to stay there. They're not going to be exported overseas. So I guess the point I want to leave you with is that it's true Oregon has amazing natural resources, but there are other resources that we need to capture in this carbon economy. And we are more than happy to answer any questions you have and, of course, serve as a resource for you moving forward.
Thank you. Representative Moon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I have a couple of questions and then a comment. And I appreciate the presentation and everything. But if I'm not right, what this basically does is it allows a company or a factory or whatever, a business who is emitting carbon and has enough money to basically buy their way out, they pay this fee per ton of carbon, and then they're allowed to continue to emit and pollute. And am I right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that generally the idea is that, and I mean, in regulated atmospheres, generally you want to see on-site reductions first, and those are mandated. But it's true, you have companies that are polluting, are emitting greenhouse gases, and are paying someone else to reduce their emissions. However, when you look at the science behind it, it doesn't matter where the emission reductions come from, as long as they're coming from somewhere. The atmosphere doesn't care. From a science, an atmospheric science perspective, which I have absolutely no background in, I should say, it doesn't matter where the emission reductions occur.
Representative Boone, may I respond to that question as well? Another way to look at it is, in order to reach the targeted levels of atmospheric greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, you not only need those emission reductions from fossil fuel generation on the utility side, but you also need emission reductions throughout other parts of the economy. And so this is one way to get at those emissions that we wouldn't cap emissions from dairies anytime soon. But I look at it as another way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in other sectors that need to be done. And you can't just solve climate change by addressing fossil fuel generation utilities. You have to look at the other sources as well.
Okay, so follow-up. And Shada, you said that 60% of the money stays in Oregon. Where does the other 40% go?
Let Ben answer that.
So over the history of the Climate Trust, there were projects funded in various states and one in Ecuador. But moving forward, we put in place last year when I joined the Climate Trust, board-approved guidelines to have a preference for Oregon projects. And so that's why we're trying to very vociferously support HB 3538 in its current form so that we can do other project types here in the state, like these good projects that we're doing with other funds.
And final. I have a final comment.
Go ahead, Representative.
I thought I'd let Co-Chair Gilliam know that there's a chance for him to be as famous as Darlene Hooley, our former congresswoman. There's a digester in Tillamook called the Hooley Digester.
You could get one named for it?
You could get one named for it if you help them create it, and
all about that.
They've been doing that for quite a while in Tillamook. Now they pick up the poop and they bring it to the digester. They digest it, and then they make power out of it, and then they take the what's left over, which is actually first I missed a step. The cows eat the grass, then they poop. They pick up the poop, then they move it to the digester, and then they digest it, and then what's left is the fiber, which then they return to the farm as bedding for the cows. And then they sleep on it and it starts all over again. And it provides power to the port area right now, and Congresswoman Hooley has gained quite a bit of fame from this.
Maybe. Representative Boone, I'm thinking your district will become a whole lot more sweet smelling to us city folk if we get these digesters.
Absolutely.
Built.
Absolutely. But we say that's the money or the smell of money in Tillamook.
We actually are looking at another project in Tillamook right now, and if we can get this bill through the Senate side, we would love to invest in a project like that.
Great.
Yeah.
Representative Thompson?
Yeah.
How do we break through the log jam to make this happen? I have a dairy in my district that's been working on this for years and still is in some kind of limbo. And inverse or continue that, why don't we have these set up on all dairies? Is it the cost, we can't sell the power coming out of them at high cost? Or what are the limiting factors that keep this from just being policy?
Sure. There are a couple of barriers. Obviously, you need the permitting to go through those kind of normal processes that take time and money. But the biggest issue right now are the capital costs. So an average digester the dairy has to be a certain size. So if the dairy has 1,000 cows, it's probably the bottom end of being feasible. If it has 500 cows, it's infeasible to put it on the dairy just because the fixed cost and the level of manure created by those 500 cows doesn't kind of justify the fixed cost. And so an average 1,500 cow dairy would need about $3 million in capital costs to set these up. If you go out there, you see the tanks, you see the cement, there's a lot of, infrastructure that's set up. And then if you have fixed costs and you borrow to cover those fixed costs, at least some of the capital, obviously, how do you pay for that? Well, Shauna talked about the revenue streams. You sell the power. You sell the digestate. You use or sell it, which saves you costs or creates revenue. You sell the carbon credits, and you sell the renewable energy credits if they're not coupled with the power purchase agreement. And so that's how they make these projects pencil. And so we don't go and develop these projects, but we work with the project developers. We work with the dairies. So there's this, you know, the expert project developers like Farm Power or Revolution Energy design the system, create the revenue sharing agreement. Basically, the farmer gets royalties, and there's revenue sharing across all of those revenue streams. And then these parties have to raise the debt and equity, and Betsy has played a key part in that, as well as federal tax credits under 1605B. And so the finance in these projects are quite difficult. We're looking at working with other sources of capital, not the carbon funds, but other sources to bring them here into these projects to help provide a new source of debt capital. As you know, the SELP program can't provide construction capital either, and so there's a gap right there. With the financial crisis, that's become a critical issue. So projects cannot find the debt financing for the projects. They can find equity easier, they can find debt. And so we're looking at working with a number of foundations, both here and outside the state, to bring in capital to plug that debt hole as well as provide carbon financing. Because we know the projects well, we can do the due diligence on them, we help bring more funding to get these projects off the ground, and that's one key aspect. One of the recommendations in the biogas paper that we'll make sure you get is providing targeted feed-in tariffs to raise the electricity price for the projects that we desire more. So if we collectively decide these are great projects, we want to do all 45 of them in the state, and we're going to give a little bit of a tariff bump for these projects, you can do that. And so that will help then cover the debt service. Or you could provide a tax incentive for the construction, like the revised Betsy structures are considering. So there are many different instruments that you can consider to help that have these projects pencil out financially. But that's the biggest barrier right now.
The feed-in tariff has been wildly successful in Vermont, which is a big dairy state.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for being here. I think we'll conclude the informational session.
Whose is this?
I think it came from the previous
panel.
I just want to say this. This entire conversation has me thinking about and reminds me very much of our discussion of cap and trade. And I say that primarily because I'm hoping that by saying the words cap and trade, a whole bunch of lobbyists will come into the room and see what's going on here. But no, in fact, it's because the whole notion of a cap and trade system was let's find the cheapest ways, let's give industry the tools, the motivation, and then the tools to find the cheapest way to get carbon reductions using a market system. And I think that's the role that offsets can help play in reducing carbon. Is there a cheaper way to get at reductions than mandatory reductions for utilities or whoever? So I think there's quite a bit of work to be done here. I appreciate the role that the Climate Trust and the other companies we heard from today are playing in that, and we'll see where we get in the interim. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Any thoughts from you, Representative Gilliam?
Well, I don't know what their background is, but it was such a strange business. The path to the Climate Trust ending up with digesters, it's just a very strange relationship. I find it very alluring, but very strange. And I certainly would never suggest that we in any way denigrate this edifice, but the idea of a digester over the Capitol building might be something to think about.
I'd also point out that Representative Gilliam has some experience with this, because when confronted with the methane problem in his district, he closed the dairy. So it's not a problem anymore. There's no problem
immediately.
We'll hear about that later.
Yeah, sure, I will too.
With that, we'll close the informational session and close today's hearing of the Energy, Environment, and Water Committee. We are adjourned.